tobacco is a dirty business all over the world. Powerful lobbies, and here in South Africa, links that have been exposed to state capture have all been laid bare in various exposés by Jacques Poe in The President's Keepers and Johan van Lochrenberg in Tobacco Wars. The President tried to stub out the growing speculation about the real reasons behind the continued ban on the sale of tobacco products after Minister Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma relayed that the Command Council had debated and decided not to lift the ban the President had said a few days earlier would indeed be lifted. While NDZ has used the excuse of a 2,000-strong petition, what is perhaps most instructive is what the President did not say in his weekly missive. While he defended the ban on alcohol to limit infection, but also to curb violence against women and children, and he also cited examples of other countries that had done the same, he offered no such explanation for tobacco, save for the following. After careful consideration and discussion, the NCCC reconsidered its position on tobacco, and as a result, the regulations ratified by Cabinet and announced by Minister Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma on the 29th of April extended the prohibition. This was a collective decision, and the public statements by both myself and the Minister were done on behalf of and mandated by the collective I lead. That's it. No public health reasons offered, no international precedent cited. Now, since government has announced that sale of cigarettes would not continue, we've certainly seen a boom in the illicit trade. We've seen smokers condemning the move, and major players in the tobacco industry have threatened legal action. Just today, British American Tobacco announced that it wouldn't be going down the legal route. We know that FETA is. So what's going on here? Let's welcome our panelists to find out. Firstly, Dr. Keith Scott, one of the founding members of the South African Drug Policy Initiative. And we've got one of the foremost experts in the tobacco industry, a policeman by experience and a lawyer by training, Johan van Lochrenberg, best known for heading the ill-fated South African Revenue Service's high-level investigative unit and author of two explosive books, Rogue, The Inside Story and Tobacco Wars. We've got Sine Klantla Nguni, chairman of the Fair Trade Independent Tobacco Association, FETA, and Ivor Sarakinski, a recovering political philosopher, as he describes himself, who teaches governance and policy at the Wits School of Governance. Welcome, gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us at a very interesting time. Johan, perhaps you can kick us off here, because in your book, SARS Rogue, you speak of, in Chapter 11, Project Honey Badger, and cite this tobacco industry as a case study for how powerful politically vested interests, organized crime, and other nefarious activities combine to influence policymakers. What makes the tobacco industry so particularly dirty in South Africa?
Well, I should say, Michael, that it's not unique to South Africa. I think the pattern is a worldwide pattern. So we should keep that in mind. Certainly in my years as a revenue service official, and many of the investigations that I'd been involved in during that period demonstrated quite clearly the close relations and nexus and overlaps between the licit and illicit trade in cigarettes, organized crime syndicates both locally and outside of our countries, politicians and politics in various forms and ways. And I recall this dating back to one of our first big cases in 2003, where the revenue service was being heavily leaned on at the time by various go-betweens and politicians and politically connected people to let go of a certain matter that we were investigating. We were always in those days at the revenue service capable of, I think, withstanding that kind of pressure and unraveling those sort of links. Up until early 2014, when I think all of these different interests began to merge, and this was during the state capture era, and I think the dam wall just broke.
The dam wall broke then. We've subsequently had the Nugent Commission of Inquiry, chaired by Judge Robert Nugent, exposing the extent to which these various organized syndicates are interacting with various politicians as well. I just want to turn now to the issue of the illicit trade and how, as investigators, you and Peter Richer and others measured the quantum or the size of the illicit trade. You go into some depth in the book about looking at how much paper is imported into the country versus what's declared to the receiver. Just give us a high-level overview of how you measure the size of the illicit tobacco trade in South Africa.
All right. I suppose the two instructive documents that would give you a simple answer that are public happen to be attachments to the South African Revenue Service Commission of Inquiry under Judge Nugent. There's one document that was presented by Mr. Cecil Morden of Treasury, and he went into quite some depth in terms of how they look at the manufacturing numbers declared versus the normal revenue flow of excise taxes associated with the manufacturing or importing and sales of cigarettes, together with the result of enforcement actions by the Revenue Service, in a nutshell. And what those graphs by him demonstrated was that the illicit part of the industry in the early 2000s was somewhere between 10 to 15%. That remained a little slightly stagnant and then began to slowly increase up to around 2012 to somewhere around 25% of the total market. By 2013, when Project Honey Badger really bit into the industry, we managed to stop that upwards trend, and it plateaued and ultimately began to drop down towards the upper tens. And then following the mass exodus and the drama at the Revenue Service, within a year, you see that spike up again. And effectively what it meant is that the normal revenue inflow based on excise taxes originating from the tobacco industry just simply decreased, markedly so. And from that, then they extrapolated a figure, which suggested an increase in the illicit trade that matched anything between 30 to 40% of the total market in South Africa. Simultaneously, the second document that was submitted by a tobacco research group of the University of Cape Town, who conduct independent research, and they've been working on the tobacco industry for a couple of years, and we have good relations with them. And they use a complete different data set and surveys and samples and a more academic type analytical approach. And they came to the same conclusion. So I would say pre-lockdown, by all accounts, the illicit portion of the tobacco sector would have been somewhere around 30%, which is quite high.
You look at the in rand terms quickly, can you quantify how much that is lost to the fiscus?
Well, the published numbers on excise attributable to cigarette manufacturing is somewhere around 15 billion per annum. And that you could then roughly say would amount to about a billion and a bit per month over 12 months. So the total worth of the South African market is estimated to be about 30 billion. So you can work out your percentages. If I say 30% of 30 billion,
yeah,
or on a monthly basis, if there's no excise tax coming in,
about a billion a month.
Looking at, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Senator Clunkley, I want to bring you in here. The Fair Trade Independent Tobacco Association, they're two big associations. TISA represents the bigger players, your British American Tobaccos, your Philip Morris's, which, by the way, we invited onto this program and they declined at the last moment. You represent many of the smaller players. Various of them, Carney Links, for example, link through to known illicit cigarette smuggler Adriano Mazzotti. Why did you decide to take government to court on Monday?
Just a point of correction. I think the Tobacco Institute of Southern Africa disbanded in December of 2019, so they no longer exist, and the manufacturers which used to form part of that body now represent themselves individually. Now, in as far as the stance by FETA to approach the courts challenging the ban on the sale of cigarettes, the decision was informed by a number of factors. We looked at the fact that over the initial few weeks, we had attempted to engage government, raising our concerns in as far as, you know, the impact on industry, the impact on smokers, and the impact on the economy of having a ban of this nature. Looking at the fact that many other countries who had successfully contained the spread of the virus, for instance, China, South Korea, and Taiwan, had not implemented such draconian measures. Now, what we state is that it is a known fact. I mean, the Nugent Commission, for instance, stated quite clearly that the illicit trade in cigarettes in South Africa is a major problem. When you look at that and the state of our borders, which are porous in nature, we knew that a ban of this nature on the sale of cigarettes would result in an influx of products entering the South African market, for instance, something which obviously would be to the detriment long-term of the legitimate cigarette industry. We also looked at psychologically the impact on smokers who would have to go, for lack of a better word, cold turkey, in as far as, you know, not being able to immediately purchase cigarettes. I mean, we know there are people who are in a fortunate position to have been able to stockpile prior to the lockdown and source these cigarettes, but the majority of South Africans will make up the approximately 11 million adult smoking population in the country would not have been able to do so. We also looked at the fact that the regulations, in as far as they stood, or as they currently stand even up till now, did not make express provision for the exclusion of the sale of cigarettes. Now, we also factored in that the Disaster Management Act, which is the overriding legislation which governs these regulations, was also not clear in as far as that is concerned. And we tried to make a submission that's similar to what the Democratic Alliance and many other leading academics and researchers have advocated, that, you know, people are being permitted to go to supermarkets, spaza shops, and other retail outlets. And why not, knowing that there is this issue of the illicit trade where people are still, I mean, the regulations have not stopped people from smoking, have a situation where you engage at least the tobacco industry in a similar fashion to how the taxi industry, for instance, was engaged, and permit smokers to purchase these cigarettes and other items which were excluded in as far as being classified non-essential goods during the lockdown period. So we are of the opinion that a less draconian solution could have been found in as far as, you know, government taking the step to ban completely the sale of cigarettes.
We're talking about the tobacco ban and the tobacco wars that have all linked into each other. Dr. Keith Scott, the decision to ban the sale of tobacco products has been given on some seemingly fairly flimsy grounds in terms of trying to stop smokers from sharing cigarettes and putting their mouths to their lips. What are we seeing as we see the illicit market grow and the prices of so-called sticks or loose jaw cigarettes increasing? What are we actually seeing the impact of this being on the ground?
Well, thank you, Michael. Yes, well, your guests, two of your guests have already touched on some of the aspects. Obviously, we put out a press release, the South African Drug Policy Initiative, right from the beginning of the lockdown, pointing out exactly what your guests have stated, that it's the poor people that couldn't stock cigarettes that suffered. And as there are probably about a million or so people who are seriously addicted to tobacco, that was actually a very cruel move. And I'll put it very firmly, it was a cruel move to do that because it denied people who had an addiction to quite a very addictive drug. Tobacco is highly addictive. And so they had to go through the, if they couldn't get illegal cigarettes, they had to go through the, the withdrawal symptoms, whereas the wealthier people could stock up and obviously didn't have to go through that. So it wasn't actually a ban on smoking. It was a ban on, initially, on poor people smoking. And in terms of the sharing cigarettes and things, all one has to do is educate people to please limit that behavior. We did it with HIV, safe sex, et cetera. So that was a spurious decision, using that as an excuse to stop people smoking. Yeah, and the other thing is that when people who use drugs like tobacco and other drugs, when they're under stress, they tend to want more of that drug. The worst thing you can do for a person who is has a substance use disorder, including tobacco, is stress them. So that's going to make them irritable and go through all the withdrawal symptoms. And the other thing is that there's no conclusive proof. There's no conclusive proof that using tobacco, smoking tobacco over the short term, does actually make you more susceptible to the COVID virus. Obviously, the comorbidities caused by tobacco, such as heart disease and lung disease, will make you more susceptible. And I've got to say this, there are some studies that show that people who smoke do have factors in their bodies caused by, caused by the tobacco, which actually does afford them some protection against a severe attack of COVID.
The French nicotine study. Ivor, there's also a political heuristic that you wrote about in the Daily Maverick today to all of this. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to connect all of the dots to who tends to benefit or stands to benefit from an increase in the illicit tobacco trade. Just connect those dots for me.
Well, my interest in this was the statement by President Ramaphosa after the NCC meeting, where he said tobacco products will be for sale. And then shortly thereafter, that was turned around, and we now have the ban, which means there's a dynamic there which we need to unpack. So the NCC advised Cabinet. Cabinet makes the decision, and the head of the NCC ratifies and promulgates that decision. So that tells us that the decision of the NCC was overturned at cabinet level, and that gives us some serious insights into the power dynamics between cabinet and the NCC and the role players in both of those institutions. So being cynical in this, you follow the money. Who benefits? And the beneficiaries are those who can sell their tobacco products outside of the legal framework. So if you're a retailer who stocks legally all the products, declares, pays tax, you can't sell, which means you've structured a market in favor of the illicit industry. On the basis of that, we look at history, we look at events, and we know there are close associations between some tobacco traders and politicians. And then if we look in the run-up of the overturning of the NCC decision, we see a strange set of events. First the ANC Women's League, then the ANC Youth League, then the MK Veterans Association. What have they got to do with public health issues?
Someone found Carl Niehaus
for a ban on tobacco. And then the cabinet turns the NCC decision around, and that means there's good grounds to suspect that there's behind-the-scenes influence peddling based on those people who benefit from the ban.
Senator Hlantla, when the Tobacco Industry Institute of South Africa, which is disbanded, as you said, in December of this year, was around, they did accuse FITA and your members, particularly Gold Leaf, of being one of the biggest beneficiaries of the illicit trade. How do you respond to that?
Look, I think those allegations have always been denied, and we've put TISA to the proof thereof. It's interesting to note that one of their members is currently embroiled with the South African Revenue Service in a dispute which dates some years back, wherein it is alleged that that particular manufacturer owes SARS somewhere to the tune of 2 billion rand in relation to those same sort of shenanigans that they accuse the FITA member of. So I think that is just them trying to defer the attention, or rather deflect attention off them and onto the smaller manufacturers which are FITA members. And this has been done worldwide by these multinationals, wherein they seek to utilize their influence and the way they lobby the media and politicians to deflect attention off from their shenanigans. I mean, we also know that, for instance, in the United Kingdom, the SFO is investigating that same multinational. We know that they're also being investigated in Bangladesh and in the United States. So that is something that we take with a pinch of salt, and we do not wish to engage in those kinds of speculations.
Johan, in your book, it's clear that it's not only the smaller manufacturers, the so-called smaller manufacturers, it's the established larger multinationals as well that have a stake in the illicit trade. So when you read comments from Adriano Mazzotti denying as outrageous these claims that he influenced NDZ and the government to ban tobacco sales, when you have the likes of British American Tobacco and Philip Morris South Africa not wanting to come onto a panel of this nature and discuss these issues, it's hard not to be cynical. It looks like everyone in the cigarette industry is benefiting from the ban right now.
Look, I should say that I want to refrain from speculation at this point until I see facts that support some of these theories that are being advanced. Being a victim of it myself, I'm very weary of that. But I should say the following. I think the fact of the matter is that there's not a single tobacco manufacturer or multinational manufacturer that supplies into the South African market that can claim innocence. They all have skeletons in their closet. Now, by and large, the public is very aware of historic skeletons in perhaps some of the smaller companies' closets. And that's thanks to the multinationals who have for many years been directing the public narrative around what is considered the illicit market and who's involved in that and who not. Of course, you know, these sort of agency, multi-agency teams that worked close with multinational companies, we would see them as, you know, the older, more established and more, I suppose, more honest companies. But as we know, and those of you that have read my book will know that the multinationals have a very long history, dating back some years worldwide in all sorts of shenanigans, bribery and corruption, money laundering, smuggling, paying massive fines all over the world. British American Tobacco is currently being investigated by the Serious Fraud Office in the United Kingdom. Some of that investigation relates to matters in South Africa, and they're also being investigated by the Justice Department as we speak in the United States of America. So it ultimately boils down to a question of not who's up to no good. I can assure you they all have skeletons. The real question should be, what is the scale of the of what they're up to and the effects on the South African economy and the population? How does that fit into the broader political discourse and issues unfolding in our country? Who's related to who? Who's linked to who? Where does the illicit proceeds end up? Do they remain in South Africa or do they go offshore? It's also the prevalence. It's also the scale of the manufacturer itself. So, for instance, to compare a Carnilinks with a British American Tobacco is simply not a comparison that one should make. They are not comparable by any means. Their only common denominator is the fact that they manufacture and sell cigarettes. The scales are different. The models are different. And a multinational company can use very aggressive base erosion practices that a local manufacturer cannot because they're simply not structured in that way. So I would say in that sense, the geographics matter, the structure, the size, the scale, the type of scams, the complexity of those scams, and ultimately what that costs not only the economy, but ultimately the government who needs this money, and ultimately the taxpayer, who has to compensate and subsidize those losses, and ultimately the beneficiaries of our tax system.
On that point,
these grants and so on.
On that point, Johan, Was it the correct decision to extend the ban on tobacco sales?
You see, again, it's the point I've been trying to make in my discussions on this matter is that because I don't know the reason for the ban, because that's never been put to us, all we've heard thus far is, well, smoking's bad for you, and therefore we're not going to allow the manufacture and trade of this. I've heard Dr. Mkhize, the Minister of Health, make that sort of statement. I've heard Minister Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma make a similar statement, although she gave practical examples of the sharing of azol and so forth. And then I've read what the President said in his recent letter and some comments quoted in the media. And it speaks to this generalized post facto afterthought that says, well, we are concerned for your health and therefore this ban. Now, my understanding of these sorts of bans or limitations that you impose upon the citizenry, one would have to have some kind of rationale, some kind of logic, perhaps discussions, consultations, and ultimately you would want to communicate that to the people so that those parts of the population that Dr. Scott spoke of, for instance, can understand this and prepare themselves. Institutions like Dr. Scott's institution can prepare for what's coming. How do we help people who then go through these withdrawal systems? And so, you know, so there must be a transparency around this. And because the explanations are vague, they're post facto, I don't know why there's this ban. I quite facetiously put up a petition recently calling for a ban on a whole list of food products that are, through many years of research, shown to be directly harmful to people who suffer from diabetes and obesity. And as we know, recent studies on COVID-19 mortality rates quote those two conditions as very high-risk conditions. And South Africa, as a country, is off the charts in respect of the number of obese and diabetic
people. I've got to stop you there. Please don't give government any ideas. We're going to see a ban on the sale of sugary drinks. We already see what's happened with the sugar beverage tax as well. But I think your point is very well made. Absence any rational reason as to why there's been a ban, a lot of this will fuel the fire of skepticism and speculation as to what the real reasons are. And I'll leave it up to you at home to connect your own dots. That was former SARS crack investigator Johan van Lochrenberg, author of Tobacco Wars, Sine Klantla Nguni, chairman of the Fair Trade Independent Tobacco Association, Ivo Sarakinski, professor of governance and policy at the Wit School of Governance, and Dr. Keith Scott, one of the founding members of the South African Drug Policy Initiative.